We're gonna start. Okay, we have a quorum, and welcome to our committee, Representative Earhart. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Government Operations and Veterans Affairs. First bill before us is House Bill 769, Representative Earhart. Does somebody would like to move the bill? Representative Strand is moving House Bill 769. You recommended the pass. Go ahead, Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I do have one amendment on page 3.
An oral amendment?
Excuse me?
An oral amendment?
Yes, I'm just going to change the date, Mr. Chairman. Page 3, line 28, sections 1 to 3 are effective July 1st, 2004. Should be the correct.
Okay. Anybody have any question on that technical amendment? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Do you want to explain your bill, sir?
Mr. Chairman and members, this bill, which seeks to make public safety radio communications operators essential employees, passed the House and the Senate last year, was included in the this committee, of course, in the full House and the full Senate. It was included in the omnibus transportation bill, but did not make it through the final process. So we're bringing it back because of its important part that these operators play in the communications system for 9/11. We're talking about roughly 80 employees who are public safety radio communication operators. Once made essential, they do not have the right to strike, and impasses in bargaining are resolved through arbitration. This bill creates a new bargaining unit for them, and the problem and the need is that if they go on strike, there's no backups. Troopers have conflicts. They tried to plug in troopers in 2001 when they had a strike, and it was not a good match because the skills that these operators have could not be transferred in the immediacy of the problem of the time. In addition, the troopers had a contractual conflict with the contractual obligation, and we're set to sue, I think, for an injunction, but the strike ended before that was carried out. State employees are the only radio communications operators that currently not classified as essential employees. All city and county radio communication operators already have designations of essential employees. And I would like to call on Colonel Beers of the Highway Patrol to flesh out my needed remarks.
Okay. Welcome to our committee, Colonel.
Mr. Chair, members, all due consideration, the authors has a strong commitment and a strong concern for what this issue is. We have 9 public safety communication centers in greater Minnesota and 1 in Metro. So there's 10 communication centers that are impacted by this.
But Colonel, for the tape, you're going to have to tell everybody. Everybody knows who you are, but you got to tell the tape. Yeah,
thank you very much. For the record, I'm Ann Beers. I'm chief of the Minnesota State Patrol. Thank you, Mr. Chair. These communication centers in 2003 answered a total of 1 million-plus telephone calls and over 400,000 911 calls. That's in total across the state. We have integrated our communication centers into what we're calling Transportation Operation Communication Centers in greater Minnesota, which is a fancy name, which means that we are now dispatching Department of Transportation as well as DNR and BCA. Along with the dispatch function of the Department of Transportation brought a lot of sophisticated automated tools and expanded the responsibilities. So since the initiation of this discussion, the job has become even more complex. This has been an evolving issue for the State Patrol. It's not a new issue. In 2001, when there was a strike, our plan for being able to perform this function within the agency took 32 troopers off of the metro highways, took them out of the schedule so that they could perform this function. The Troopers Association did file an injunction with the court, and I'm not sure that that would be a viable option for us for future strikes. In this past year, when we were planning for the potential of a strike, we did consider troopers as our first option for many reasons. They know the operations of the State Patrol. They know our procedures. They know the emergency response procedures and working with other law enforcement agencies. They understand our codes. They understand our badge numbers and the geographics. Our backup plan for that would be to use the National Guard. We contacted the National Guard. They're more than willing to assist us. But the complexity of this job has evolved to the point where I'm not sure that it's reasonable to bring somebody in without the operational knowledge of police functions and State Patrol specifically, that they could get behind the council and be able to effectively dispatch without compromising the safety of troopers and the public. The plan was to bring in 70 National Guard and train them in advance of this so that they would have some understanding of what's happened. The sophistication has now grown within the State Patrol even since last year. Last year, one of our communication centers had a computerized dispatch function in Metro only. That's now expanded into Rochester District, and the plan is to have that further distributed across the state this year. So the function is completely automated and takes a great deal of knowledge to be able to form the function. We've also transferred out our telephone system. It's not a telephone anymore, it's a computer. I was just at our communication center in metropolitan area this week, participating with the tour. I looked at the sophistication of the council, and we explained that this is the telephone sitting right there, and it's a computer screen. So to bring somebody that's not indoctrinated into what that means and what those procedures are would be a very complicated issue. For all purposes, the State Patrol has considered radio communication operators essential to our operations. They're already weather essential, which means that in a snowstorm, they don't get to go home at the end of their 8-hour shift or their 10-hour shift. We hold them over. We call them in if we anticipate a weather storm. Sometimes in greater Minnesota, they can't get home and actually physically stay in the district offices because of that. When we were talking about furlough planning at the end of 2001, troopers and RCOs were both exempt from that furlough planning because we knew that they were essential to our operations and we couldn't perform our function without jeopardizing the safety of troopers. As Representative Earhart talked about, for the strike planning, it was extensive planning, and not only would putting a trooper at the council create some other issues, maybe with a court injunction, but also we diminished our trooper staffing on the road around the state to be able to staff that communication center on a 24-hour basis. Specifically for Metro alone, as I said, it was 32 troopers that we had to pull off the road 2 weeks in advance of the anticipated strike to do adequate training and be able to put them in a position to be able to do this job. And then that meant that there were 32 troopers fewer out on the road doing their job and ensuring that we were responding to incidents and crashes on the road. So it's a critical issue for us. It's very important. It's not a new bill. We were here last year. As the representative said, it passed through the House. And I just appreciate your support and consideration of this.
Thank you very much. On the amendment to change the date from 03 to 04, I forgot to say there's Representative Strand's amendment as well. Correct, Representative Strand? So for the official record, we just wanted to, Representative Strand moves the amendment, the oral amendment to change 03 to 04. And I just ask that we have an official vote on it again now. So all in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Fine. Thank you very much. Okay. Do you have any others that want to testify? Any questions of the chief? People in the audience that would like to testify? Come on down.
Thank you.
Welcome. Please
Thank
introduce
you, Mr.
yourself
Chairman.
For the record.
My name is Brian Berkson. I am the Legislative Affairs Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. I represent some 11,000 organized state workers. MAEP is strongly against any bill that would make essential state employees. State workers have one thing that they can use when contract and great negotiations go awry, and that is to withhold their labor. And what you heard the state just testify to is it was really difficult for us when we were going to have a strike, so this is why we need to do this. Well, if they paid a living wage, if they didn't freeze the pay, if they didn't outsource jobs overseas, and if they didn't attempt to privatize jobs within every department and send the jobs over to India, maybe they wouldn't have to worry about a potential work stoppage. We are strongly against this because it is our last resort, but it is our only resort when we do not come to a conclusion during contract negotiations. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the witness? Representative Kahn?
Chairman, one of the things that questions that we had about this last year was what kind of, sir, I think they had one or two employees who talked about it, but what kind of survey of the employees of the unit had we had to see what was, what their opinion was? I mean, we had one or two people, I think, who were basically hired during the strike, and we had the union people telling us that everyone was against it. I wonder what's been done in terms of trying to find out what the rank and file members.
I think we have an answer. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Kahn, for the record, my name is Julie Blau, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 6, and we are the council that represents the RCOs throughout Minnesota. We have 69 RCOs within our public safety local, and within the transportation local, we have 9. And to go directly to the issue of the survey that was done, it's our understanding that that was a survey that was done within the State Patrol asking the questions. What we have done with our membership is go back to them and ask them for their input into this issue. And the response I received back from the business agent was to let this committee and the legislature know that they are strongly opposed to this bill and they want to retain their right to strike. And that's as clear as I can make it. Thank you.
So what we heard last year was it was just most of them wanted to be essential, and what you're saying now is most of them do not want to be. Most of them being roughly what percentage? And then we'll have Colonel Beers, and then I'll get to your question in a second. What percentage do you know?
Mr. Chairman, the response to the percentage, I couldn't state an actual percentage. I'm stating the discussions that the locals have had and the local leadership has had with the RCOs within the local. And of that, I can state that there are 69 RCOs in the public safety local, in local 3142. And the message that they sent with me today is when they have talked with the RCOs, and keep in mind that these folks were out on strike during the last strike. They so chose to strike, and they want to retain their right to strike.
Okay. Colonel, did you have a comment on that?
For the record, again, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ann Beers, Chief of the State Patrol. An internal survey done by our own RCOs. Management did not take this survey. It was informal. It was done statewide. Showed that 57 out of the 69 RCOs are in favor of it. It's unanimous in Greater Minnesota, the 9 communication centers in Greater Minnesota, and we're about equally divided within our Metro Communication Center. We do have a radio communication operator from Duluth that was part of taking that survey. If that would help inform the committee, we'd be happy to make him available to you.
Okay, let's take some questions here. Representative, did that point?
Anything.
Okay, well, we got Representative Lippman, Ellison, and then you can go. Representative Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Belial, I'm just wondering whether you dispute Colonel Beers' characterization that there aren't any other good training options as far as replacements. I mean, would you at least, I know that there might be a policy difference about what to do about that or whether there should be replacements, but you don't necessarily dispute the fact that that there aren't any good options for her if state workers go out on strike.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Whitman, let me say that it's a very high compliment, and we hold in with very high regard the work that our members, the RCOs, do throughout Minnesota. But as far as alternatives, that is an ongoing issue, as it is with any potential strike and backup replacements. And do I feel that they have the capacity to deal with this? Yes, I do. And I think the last strike demonstrates that this was not an issue during the last strike, and I think the situation takes care of itself.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, just so that I understand Ms. Belial's testimony, and the capacity is to take troopers off of other assignments to man these posts, is that what you mean by your testimony, just so I understand your answer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Littman, I am not going to speak for the patrol and what they decide and who they decide to put into those positions. That's their decision.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Blatt, and I don't mean to belabor the point. I'm just trying to understand what is in dispute and what isn't. I mean, do you have a dispute that she doesn't have? She says she doesn't have viable options. Is it your testimony that she does? And if they are, what are those options for her that make sense? I'm just trying to understand the nature of the disagreement.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Whitman, to say it very simply, I don't think that's in dispute. I think the last strike demonstrates that there was not a problem in this area, and if they so choose to put individuals, it's no different than any other positions that need to be replaced. That's their decision.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Okay, Representative Ellison.
If radio employees were to be designated essential, how would that impact your ability to bargain with management?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, any time employees are declared essential, it takes away, first and foremost, their individual right to strike, their individual responsibility of not being able to withhold their labor from their position. Overall, any time you take away the right to strike from any members within any union, that weakens their position.
Representative Ellison?
Could you also, Mr. Chair, could you also address the issue of what incentive would management have to bargain in good faith if they know that their workers can't strike?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I think that your question provides that answer, in that when you get right down to it, that is a major issue with regard to them not having the right to strike. And it's a fundamental issue when it comes to unions. It's a fundamental issue when it comes to negotiations.
One more, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, could you speak to the issue? If you could just project into the future, and I know I'm asking you to speculate somewhat, but if you could just project into the future or look at other examples around the country, what would you expect to happen to the labor to the pay and conditions and overall package of the radio workers if they were deprived of the right to strike? You understand my question?
Okay.
What would happen to their working situation in terms of pay and conditions over time? What do you foresee?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, whether it be the RCOs or whether it be any individual union member, once you have taken away their ability and their right to strike, it weakens their position individually as well as it does the local, as well as it does the union. And I think the long term for this country, anytime we take away the right to strike from any union members, we have weakened the position as far as pay, benefits, and working conditions.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Silberg. And then to that point, Representative Strand.
Just to that point, I mean, Mr. Chair, we're sort of talking about collective bargaining 101 here. And as a union employee myself who does not have the right to strike, who is an essential employee, I'm not sure that the characterization that we are inherently weakened and wages will be driven down is entirely accurate in all cases, just from looking at the record. So just to clarify that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Solberg, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try to educate my colleague to my right.
Okay.
But, Mr. Chairman, you know, there are surveys and surveys, and it depends upon how you ask the question on surveys. And we've heard that 50 out of 69 or something like that want it. And I'd like to know, and then we have conflicting that the majority of them do not want it, or large majority. I guess in order for me to weigh that, I need to, first of all, see who asked the question, what the question was that was asked on both sides of this table. And that's been around a while. I wonder if Ms. Beer could be able to give us that information of what question was asked and by who.
Chief?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the question was not asked by me. It was not a management survey. We wanted to make sure that there wasn't any intimidation or any reflection from our position. So it was a survey done within their own unit. Steve DeHaan is here from our Duluth district, who was instrumental in that survey and compiling those results. If you'd like to hear from him, most certainly be willing to
Mr.
do that.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to see what the question was asked.
Let's have him come down and answer your question.
Mr. Chairman, I know we're interrupting Ms. Bly's testimony. I don't know if you want to take her.
You.
She has a
Did you have some comments, or can we continue on with the question?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to testify. The other point I'd like to make is that when this survey was actually done, because if I remember right, we were discussing the same survey during the legislative committee hearing a year ago, and the information that I'm providing you is information that I received yesterday from our business agent from recent discussions within the local.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Sir, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stephen DeHaan, and I'm an RCO in Duluth. And Representative Solberg wants to know what the question was. What the question was posed to the RCO is, knowing that the only guaranteed item with being essential is that you will lose your right to strike, and no other promises or guarantees being made, do you still want to be essential? And what Chief Beers, figures that Chief Beers gave were accurate. All of the out-state, 100% of the out-state RCOs wanted to be essential, and approximately half of the metro RCOs still wanted to be essential.
Mr. Chairman, I think that the first statement that the witness said in a survey has a tendency to be an opinionated survey to begin with. So you're leading it. The question, I'd like to see it written down. I wonder if that if you would provide me with a written test.
I can provide it. I don't have it here with me, but I do have a copy of an email that was sent out, and it was simply stating the only thing guaranteed is that you will lose your right to strike.
Very fine. Well, Mr. Chairman, that may or may not be an actual case. That's the only thing you lose. So, but I appreciate the witness coming forward and being able to provide me with that survey question.
To the point, Representative Jacobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Solberg, you give me an interesting thought. I find that an interesting question. I was wondering if Ms. Bly would share what their question
sure.
is, so we can see.
I want it both.
I think that's
okay, let's get the other side. That's fair.
Because like you say,
you've got to come back down again.
How you ask the question quite often frames things.
So the question is, what did you ask? When did you ask it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think I wanted both sides to give me that. What the and again, timing is important, too. If it was a result of a question shortly after a strike, it may have a different time frame than 2 years later.
Yep.
But I think that's an important question to be able to ask.
Okay. Well, welcome again.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, to the best of my understanding, the question was asked by the local president to the individual RCOs and their travels around the state, and also in discussion at the local AFSCME local 3142 meeting. And that's the local that represents the RCOs. The wording of the question was in regard to this issue coming up again. And I have to say that last year there were some RCOs that made contact with us in support of becoming essential. This year, we have not received that contact, and moreover, what we have received is a very strong message from the local to make sure this legislation is not adopted.
Representative Silver? Mr. Chairman, I wonder if Ms. Bly could try from her employees or the local representatives to get us a written form of what the question was asked also. Mm-hmm.
Would you do that for
Mr. Chairman, Silver, yes I will.
Mr. Chairman, yes, may I interject that Local 3142 approximately has 850 members, 69 of which are RCOs.
Right.
If you ask 850 employees, which I am a strong labor person, I believe in the right to strike. However, being in the position that I am, I feel it's more important for an RCO to be a lifeline to someone making a 911 call than to be out on the picket line. And again, 850 members versus 69 RCOs, you will find that the majority of 3142 is opposed to RCOs being essential.
Okay, and you were asked the question as well, is that correct?
No, I was not.
You were not asked the question?
No, I was not.
And the reason for that was?
I have no idea, sir.
Okay. Representative Solberg?
Well, Mr. Chairman, as one who is belongs to a union also, or has over the years, and had the unfortunate experience of carrying a picket line for a month. And also, there's nothing in the law that says if you feel strongly, even though your unit may be on strike, that you can't report to work.
In fact,
some of my colleagues did that. And I mean, taking the right to strike away from somebody doesn't mandate, or giving somebody the right to strike does not mandate that they have to strike, even though the unit may be on strike.
So if the RCOs are on strike, you could still go across that picket line and continue on, and whatever negotiations are after the strike would apply to you as well.
That's right.
Okay. I don't know if you draw pay if you're there or not. I don't understand.
You get paid just like you're working.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, yes, Representative Solberg, I understand that during the last strike, I did go on a strike for several days, and I knew that I needed to be at my post. And for an example, the day that I came back and crossed the line, I answered a 911 call in the middle of the night from a woman who was desperate because her six-week-old baby was not breathing. And I can tell you that if anybody other than a professional RCO, National Guard, a trooper, the troopers even told me, they would not have been able to tell that woman what to do to keep her baby alive. It's a mighty powerful bargaining chip, someone's life. 69 people have a great deal of power. They do literally have the power of life and death. If they are not at their position and someone calls in, someone can die. That is the honest facts.
And I think I appreciate what you had to say, because I think as a state employee, and we represent all the people in the state, we really appreciate our state employees for their dedication for what you're doing. I don't think there's anybody here that would ever say that that don't. I mean, so please know that no matter how this turns out, that your dedication to what you're doing, your job you're doing, and saving people's lives and assisting them, whatever, is well recognized, and we really appreciate it very much. Ms. Blyle?
Mr. Chairman, just one additional comment, and this gets back to Representative Ellison's question, but it emphasizes Representative Solberg's point also, and that is, by placing these people, you're placing them in a separate bargaining unit. They're now 69 members rather than as an entire bargaining unit. The separate point is, you're taking away the right to strike from those who so want to strike. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Anybody else in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Strand, Representative Smith, Chairman Smith would like to see the bill in his committee, which is a prerogative of the chairs. Would you mind amending your motion so that it go to that committee, recommend to pass and go to that committee? Okay, that's the way it is. So
Mr. Chairman, may I ask, this was not a consideration last year, same bill, change of date. What is the nature of Chairman Smith's request?
actually, every chairman, including yourself, have the right to, and here we've got bills back here all the time, but if they have requests that have come to them, we just honor it.
I don't think that's essentially true, Mr. Chairman, but if you want to send it to Smith's committee, okay.
Well, that's what it is, but I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll move that it be recommended to pass to Judiciary Finance Committee, and if that motion doesn't prevail, then we'll go that way. Does that seem fair to everybody? So the motion is that it be recommended pass and go to Judiciary Finance Committee as amended. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? No.
Aye.
That does not prevail. Now we're back on the motion originally, which is to recommend it to pass to the floor, General Register, as amended. That would be Representative Strand's motion. All in favor of that, say aye.
Mr. Chair.
Can that happen? Doesn't it have implications?
Well, it was voted down by this committee, so
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Lippman.
Representative Smith, Chairman Smith believes that's the case. When it's a report presented to the entire House,
the bills go through all committees also, but I sure understand the prerogative of chair to request a bill that they feel has jurisdiction on it. I mean, we may not like that process, but that's the process that the majority has always had. I don't think you guys want to start weakening your own majority ability of a chair to request the bill.
We're
going to go back to the motion of House File 769 as amended be recommended passed to the House floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Division. All in favor raise your hands. And all, is that, got them? And all against? Doesn't prevail on a vote of 7 in favor and 9, so the bill is not going anywhere but here, I guess. He's right here. Sorry. Thank you. Next bill is before us is Representative Pennis, House File 2105. Do you want to come down now after this last thing? All right. And if you have any witnesses or anybody's going to testify with you, that's fine.
I would move this bill,
and then I would probably want to make an opportunity at later on to have it considered for consent count.
Okay.
After testimony.
All right. Representative Solberg is moving House 2105 to the General Register with possibility if there's a consensus to the consent calendar. Boy, that sounds pretty good right off the get-go. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's the first time I've ever been in front of this committee, so... House File 2105 deals with...
Is this your first time?
In this committee.
Now we got to think about this for a minute here.
Where are the trees?
You just let the bill die. Are you sure you want...
Oh, okay. Well, I can make arrangements.
All right. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill that you have before you deals with the IRRB or IRRA, the Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation Agency. And you might wonder why I'm carrying it. About a year ago, I was appointed to that board, and it has been a real growing experience for me. This bill is rather short, and what it does is to reinstate the language to the office of the commissioner, which was in statute until 1997. With that, I will stop and refer to commissioner of the agency, Sandy Lehman.
Hi, welcome to our committee.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Sandy Lehman, commissioner of Iron Range Resources. We're using a little shorter identity these days. Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Agency is sort of a mouthful. But as Representative Pennis noted here, we're asking for sort of a simple action here. in that we're asking that language that was previously in state statutes and eliminated erroneously in 1997 be restored. And just simply, the agency of Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation Agency was established in 1941. In 1941, it was established in state statutes, creating the Office of the Commissioner. In 1943, a board was also established in state statutes. However, in 1997, state staff in the Department of Employee Relations, thinking that they were doing some cleanup work, omitted the language that created the Office of the Commissioner. Our office, in contact with the revisor's office, asked to have it restored. We were advised that the agency handle it legislatively. Since that time, we've also received a legislative audit in the year 2002 that had three primary recommendations, the first of which was to clean up statutory language that was rather unclear about the agency and the board. And we are here today with the first step in that effort.
Thank you. Any questions? Well, as long as you're here, would you like to testify, sir? Welcome.
This is Deputy Commissioner Brian Heady.
Deputy Commissioner, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please identify yourself for the record if you have anything you'd like to say.
No, I don't think I'm just here for backup if the commissioner needs me.
All right. Representative T.
Who gets paid?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's not a commissioner now. What is this? What is the bill do exactly?
The bill just reinstates language that originally established the office of the commissioner of the agency. Yes, there is a commissioner. I am she.
No, I understand. That's where my question is coming from. You're sitting there. You're the commissioner. What
this does is really just restore the legal language that we are using in all of our legal transactions at the agency. All documents that I sign contain the language Office of the Commissioner of Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation Agency. This is at the recommendation of attorneys and the Legislative Audit Committee that performed an audit on our agency in the year 2002.
Mr. Chairman, it does seem like I think it was a mistake, 1997, a drafting error, almost the type that could have been, if it had been caught, would have been put in the revisor's bill. So if your indulgence, if the committee would like, I would like to have it considered for a consent calendar item.
Any objection from anybody? Looks like that's the way it's going to go. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify for or against this? Seeing none. Representative Solberg renews his motion on House File number 2105 be recommended pass to the consent agenda. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? It's done.
Thank you.
Come back and see us again. It's just like this for everybody. Well, not quite everybody. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Haas. And you are moving 2034, and where does that go?
Ways and Means, Mr. Chair.
To Ways and Means. Directly? Without us?
I don't think we
committee?
Need to see it in my committee because most of the members are here. So,
do you want just to go? Are you serious about Ways and
Means? I think we should just go to Ways and Means for the union contracts.
Chairman Nabok, he says it's fine. All right.
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the motion is House File 234 be recommended pass and move to Ways and Means. And members, House File 2034 is the ratification of the union contracts that have been negotiated through the last half of last year. Before you, the bill addresses the MAPE, AFSCME, MNSCU administration, and faculty and staff. It also sets the salaries for the director of HESO. We reviewed the policy in the LCC, the Subcommittee for Employee Relations, and had discussion in there. As we went through this last year, you know, with the budget constraints, it was very difficult for both sides to sit down and negotiate because there was no money, and the unions wanted an increase. So what we came out with, there's no basic pay increase that somebody get a 2 or 3%, but within the grid, there are increases that a person will get because of time and service and their position and merit. So those there were adjustments there. There were changes to the contributions of the health insurance was another area. The employee will be paying a little more for their health insurance plans this year. So members, that is the what you have before us today. And Mr. Eubinger is here, and Mr. Paul Larson is here from Employee Relations to answer any questions. And I think there's some representatives from the union who may want to make a statement on this. So
okay, anybody want to come down and testify for or against?
Judy, do you want any questions? Do you want to say anything, or
Judy, do you want to come down?
Okay.
And then, okay, we have a couple of questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Blau, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 6, and we would urge that the committee move this bill forward and ratify the contract that's before you. Thank you.
Very good. I have Representative Silver got a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I wonder if Mr. Eubinger or somebody can ask a question to me for me. Or, I'm looking at Subdivision 6, the HESO Director, and I noticed the salary of the HESO Director goes from $97,000 to $108,000. And I'm not privileged to serve on that employee subcommittee anymore, but I know that that's been some changes in that agencies over the years. And first of all, I'd like to ask the question of the number of employees within that agency. Does anybody know?
Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg, I believe that HESO has approximately 85 employees.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, can you tell me why there was a justification for an over $9,000 increase to that position when I don't think any other ones received that kind of an increase?
Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg, the governor's office proposed that increase to reflect the change in the status of that position. Legislation passed during the 03 session changed that position so that it was now a cabinet-level position, and the director is now appointed by the governor. And as a gubernatorial appointee in a cabinet-level position, the governor's office thought that that person's salary ought to be the same as other agency heads.
Mr. Chairman, I don't dispute that probably wish, but let me ask a question. Is that the top of that grid of the cabinet level?
Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg, it is not. The maximum salary for that range for those agency heads is $114,000.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Eubinger, are all the rest of the commissioners on that level as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, there are basically two ranges for most agency heads. The vast majority are in group one, which has that range, maximum salary of $114,000.
And Mr. Chairman, maybe we can just have some justification why the legislature chose to put that commissioner in that range.
Mr. Eubinger, any insight?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, that position has been in that range for since at least 1997. So with the legislation that passed during the 03 session, that did not change.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Eubinger, I have a question. I was just wondering, or Representative Haas, if you might be able to characterize the discussion that occurred at the LCC level about this, whether there was any vote, and what is the best judgment of the LCC on ratification.
Good. Mr. Chair and Representative Lippman, we did vote on this, and it was unanimous on the vote. We reviewed the information in the contracts and felt it was a fair settlement and it worked within the parameters that were set by the legislature.
Further member discussion on House File 2034.
Mr. Chairman, just one more question, and that's in Subdivision 4, the performance-based increases up to 2.75%. Mr. Eubinger, is that available to all 1,160 employees that are in that unit?
Mr. Eubinger.
Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg, employees who are at the top of their range are not eligible to receive those increases. I think 45% or so are eligible to receive them.
And Mr. Chairman, do we have any, since this has in effect been ratified, do we have any track record of how many of the 45% have received the performance base?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, we don't have that information.
Mr. Chairman, could we have it? Could we get it?
By Ways and Means, we'll have it.
Would you please?
Okay.
The reason, Mr. Chairman, I ask that question is sometimes it's called performance base and it becomes automatic.
Further member questions on House File 2034? Further member discussion? If not, Representative Haas renews his motion that House File 2034 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. Representative Jacobson moves that the minutes of Tuesday, February 24, 2004, be approved as drafted. Any discussion on that motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. With that, this committee is adjourned.